This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. For the Publishing Talks series of interviews, I've talked to publishers, editors, technologists, and many others who have been involved with the book industry, past, present, and future. Today's conversation is very different. The Whiting Awards have been given to 10 writers annually by the Whiting Foundation, based in New York City. Each year since 1985, Whiting has chosen 10 early-stage writers of exceptional talent in fiction, poetry, nonfiction, and drama to receive unencumbered grants, at first in the amount of $25,000 each, and today for $50,000 each. These grants cannot be applied for, and the selection process is extremely opaque. Winners are chosen by an anonymous rotating group of selectors and are always surprised by this recognition and belief in their work. As such, the Whitings are a unique form of support for contemporary literature and have been incredibly beneficial, having awarded grants to 300 emerging talents in a 30-year time span. A large number of Whiting grantees have gone on to significant literary careers. If you visit their website, you can see some of the names. It's my pleasure today and honor to have the opportunity to speak about the history of the Whitings and this program with the person most singularly responsible for its existence, that is, aside from Flora Whiting, who endowed the foundation in the first place. Robert Penoyer, an attorney of some note, was an original trustee of the foundation. It's really his effort, at the suggestion of his wife, the poet Victoria Parsons Penoyer, that initiated this amazing program. I spoke with Bob Penoyer, who is still an active attorney at 90 years of age, in his office in New York City.
This is David Wilk. I'm with Robert Penoyer, also known as Bob. We're talking today about the history of the Whiting Awards for poetry and literature. And I wanted to start by talking to you, Bob, about your wife, Victoria Parsons Penoyer, who was Vicky, who was a poet. And wanted to ask you what, you know, when did she start writing and how did she become a poet?
Vicky was her real writing started sometime in the 60s, when she was by then, about 30 years old. Mm-hmm. But she had always very bright. When she was in at Brearley School here in New York, she wrote an essay of some kind that was so good, the teacher accused her of plagiarizing.
Yep.
And the headmaster called her to accuse her of plagiarizing. And Vicky said, oh, I wrote this. And if you wrote it, then sit down and write it again. It was very, so she left the school. She just, it's terrible to accuse a child of cheating.
Well, especially when you did not cheat.
Yes, exactly.
That's terrible.
Yes. So anyway, she was always very bright. And she had a, and also she grew up in a family where the, her father was in a wheelchair most of the 30 years I knew him. In the 1930s, when they didn't travel, they had the children at home in the evening. They read a lot of literature out loud, Dickens and all great literature.
Prior to no television.
She was sensitive to words. Her father had been the class poet at Harvard. Her grandmother had written extensively herself and wrote a memoir of her own. And Vicky just loved words, loved poetry. She knew poetry, knew literature. And so it came naturally. And I learned a lot. I was being educated all my life.
So, and she actually had two books that were published.
Yeah, what happened, she'd write poems and scraps of paper, and it went on for after some 10 years or 15 years. I said, Vicky, we should make a book. Well, how do we do that? I said, well, let's get the scraps together, and Agnes, my secretary, will type up a proof to give to a printer. So we did that with one book, and it came out beautifully. She's very proud of it. And then we did a second book because she kept on writing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so so when she wrote poetry, she wrote longhand, and then someone typed for her, right? Were there any particular poets you remember that she loved more than others?
Oh, of course, Keats. the Elizabethan poets, the romantic poets, the English romantic poets. But she loved Auden, Dord Auden, and Hardy, and Keats, of course, Shelley. She knew poetry. She remembered it. She also herself, she made up words to express what she felt. And that was, and she had incredible powers of observation. She wrote a whole novel based on characters that did not exist, but it was so beautiful, the description of these people and situations they were in that she'd never been in herself. She had this imagination. She was very creative, is what it was.
So whatever happened to the novel?
Well, I said the drawer back at home because it went through several editions over about 10 years. She showed it to Jonathan Galassi. He said he couldn't publish it, and she didn't bother to pursue that. Right. And she never tried. She wrote short stories, wonderful short stories, never tried to get them published. That was a shame. And so at some point, my children want to take the novel and maybe print it, publish it privately.
Right. Yeah,
might be something
should,
we could do.
You would want the family to see it.
Yes. Because she had a character. The character she wrote about, a young boy named Jake, who lived in Manhattan and did queer things. He was an iconoclast. It was became so familiar in the family. It was like one became almost a member of the family, the lead character. we joked about him.
Oh, that's
and the grandchildren loved it.
So what is the connection between your wife and you and the Whiting Foundation?
Well, the history of the Whiting Foundation plays into this. In 1970, Mrs. Giles Whiting died, probably in her 80s. She had no children. She hated paying taxes. And her lawyer was my partner, Chauncey Belknap. And Belknap told her to avoid paying taxes, leave it to a foundation. And she had no interest in charity. She might have given $100 a year to the Girl Scouts or something. But so when she died, we had $10 million. And Belknap asked me to become a trustee along with, Belknap was then in his 80s, and he was a trustee at Princeton, and Mrs. Whiting's doctor was a Dr. St. John, who was also a trustee of Princeton. So he asked St. John and me and the minister at St. James Church to be the initial board. So we met in the rectory up at St. James Church, and St. John said, "Chick, you're the oldest. What do we do with the money?" And because the foundation had the broadest, we could decide to do anything. And Belknap said right away, "The sciences have received much too much support. I want to help the humanities." So he then got Bob Goheen was the president of Princeton. He called him up and said, "Bob, I want to see you at the University Club next Thursday at 4 p.m. So I went with him, and we sat in the stuffed chairs overlooking Fifth Avenue, the University Club on 54th Street. And Belknap said, "Bob, I want to do something for the humanities." And Goheen rattled off five things for Princeton. No, Bob, that's not what I mean at all. I want something of general purpose for the humanities, which will apply not just to Princeton. And right at that meeting, Goheen said, "The most critical need is the PhD scholars, some of the best in the country, cannot finish their dissertations because they've been working in scholars for so many years. By then, they have families. They need to go get jobs. And so we lose some of the best people that academia needs. So if you give a dissertation year fellowship to a PhD scholar, it would be very, very helpful." And Belknap said, "Thank you." And then he checked with six or seven other universities, the deans of these arts and science programs, and they concurred that was a critical need. And then, but Belknap specified, it will be merit based solely on merit, not on need. Mm-hmm. And Howard said, "No, we have to have need." Belknap said that he won't get the grant. So from 1970s to early 80s, we did nothing. The check, the foundation was a checkbook and a drawer. Once a year, wrote checks for $600,000, $800,000, $1 million, to enough to fund a fellowship for one out of eight of the doctoral candidates at that university in a PhD program that year. And because the university picked the best of the best, the Whiting Fellowship in the Humanities became a mark of distinction nationwide. And if a scholar got that, they would leave with almost certain of employment. And after some years, we did a survey, and these scholars were working at universities all over the country, in Europe too, but I think at 200 different universities. So then in the 1980s, Belknap retired, or whatever, and I became the president of the Whiting Foundation. And we began, our endowment had increased from 10 million to maybe 50 million.
It's a pretty big increase.
So yeah. We had more money, and Vicky, who we used to have to go with Belknap once a year to each of these universities to hear a dinner, have dinner with the fellows and listen to them talk about their dissertations. It was so boring. Vicky came to these things. Why don't you, if you have more money, do something for the creative person? How about fellowship for writers? I said, great idea. And then then I took that idea and somehow got hold of a man named Champion Ward, who'd been in the cultural program at Ford Foundation. And he right away suggested talking to Gerald Freund, who had been running the fellowship program at Rockefeller Foundation. And Jerry Freund said, what you really want to do is to have a program that makes awards to writers in the early stages of their careers. So the Whiting Writers Award came into being. It was Vicky's idea, but we had help putting it together. And Jerry Freund ran the program for some 10 years from probably the mid-80s on. But the people who really know the background. So what happened was, when he set up the program, Jerry Freund knew a lot of people in the cultural world, and writers and editors and publishers. And so he put together a selection committee at the beginning of each year of five or six known people, all of whom had names, and it was done anonymously. The selection committee would then have, we had a staff person, they came up with a list of people the selection committee recommended. We solicit nominations, and the nominations came from all over the country.
And who would be qualified to make a nomination? How did you?
There were professors at universities. There were editors. There were writers. And in fact, anyone who won a Whiting could make a nomination. So right. It began to snowball. But usually we got in over 110 recommendations from young writers, mostly young, not all, some few were in their 50s, even 60s.
But they were still at early
stages. Still at early stages,
yes.
Whose best book was yet to come.
Right.
But getting hold of their manuscripts, or sometimes a published book, would be difficult to do, but our staff person who ran the program for many years, Kelly Rosner, found a way to get hold of these manuscripts without the nominee knowing about
right.
it.
Right, so this was, that's a really interesting point.
Yeah.
In other words, you would have nominations, but the person being nominated did not know.
Right, did not know.
So, yeah, you could see how
so
it would
when
be
you
difficult.
Win out, when it took a whole year-long process, by August, they winnowed it down. They had a meeting usually up in New Hampshire somewhere, I forget why, of the selection committee for over a weekend to go through the nominations and winnow it down to 10 people. And maybe more than one meeting took to do that. But when they picked the 10, the 10 didn't even know they'd been considered.
Right.
And the other 90 didn't know whether they were not winners.
Right.
There were no losers.
Which is good, actually. It's
wonderful.
Better to know that you were not a loser.
So my only role then was in September to call these people. We had an award ceremony in October, usually at the Morgan Library. And I was told, as the president of the foundation, I had to call them because the selection committee didn't want to even know they were.
Right. So they would stay anonymous.
Yeah, stay anonymous.
Even
yeah.
after the award was made.
Yeah.
So you would never know.
No one ever knew.
Wow.
And so I would call the winners and tell them you just won $25,000. You won't believe what I'm telling you. So, because in the early days, no one ever heard of the Whiting Fellowship and the Whiting Writers Award. So, so I'll give you the name and a number you can call to verify what I'm telling you. And funny things happened. One young woman called back a few minutes later and reached Kelly Rossenheim, the director of the Whiting program, and or assistant director, and says, some guy with a phony English accent just called me. Another, I was also called at about 9:30 in the morning. It must have been 8:30 in St. Louis. And I reached a young girl, and she said, just a minute, I have to put on some clothes to be able to talk to you. Anyway.
Did anybody ever yell at you and say,
no, no.
You know, don't call me.
No, no.
You must be lying. Or
no, no, no. So then after 5 years or so, word got around there was a Whiting Writers Award, and he didn't have to explain it anymore.
Right.
They began to believe what they were told.
Did writers, though, once it became well-known, did you then have people calling and saying, how can I apply?
I never got a call like that. Kelly might have gotten calls, but I think it was pretty well-known that you couldn't apply. I think, there was no flood of applications.
So in that way, you were like the MacArthur Foundation, where the MacArthur nominees don't know that they've been nominated. There's no way you can't apply. All chosen by people that you don't even know who they are. So,
then we'd have this awards ceremony at the Morgan Library and get a speaker. And I'd always have lunch with the speaker a few couple of weeks before the speech to urge them to keep it short, 20 minutes, and told them what the procedure would be. We'd have the awards handed out, and then the award would come with a check and a book, or folded into a book, and then they could speak. 20 minutes, please. And of course, some of the people who spoke were made great, great speeches. Ralph Ellison spoke. And he told me at lunch, a couple of weeks before the meeting, that he had been, his parents had run a drugstore in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and they did not have the money to send him east when he got a scholarship to go to Eastern University. So he found a friend in the railroad yards, a hobo, who told, I'll show you how to ride the rails. I'll get you to New York.
So he came.
It took 2 or 3 weeks to ride the rails. He said the problem was he had to get around or go around Arkansas, because if he got caught in Arkansas, he'd be put in a chain gang for 5 years. So that was how he got to New York and got to the university.
That's amazing.
I think he went to Columbia. I'm not sure. I think it was Columbia.
It's a pretty good story.
So, but then, and Ralph, Robert Giroux of a famous publishing house regaled us with anecdotes about his career as an editor, and particularly in his early years, and he asked T.S. Eliot whether most editors aren't failed writers.
Mm.
And Eliot told him, well, most writers are failed writers. So, but I remember that Eudora Welty, when Saul Bellow spoke, I told Saul, we'll have a podium with a glass of water. No, make it straight vodka. So it was great fun. Then after doing this for, you know, it cost something to rent the library and pay for the event and pay for the transportation to the event. Was it worth doing was the question. And we canvassed, after about 6 or 8 years, we canvassed the people who'd come to these award ceremonies as to whether it was important to continue it. And unanimously, it was just as important as the award, because it gave them credibility with people, including their families, who thought they were wasting their time trying to be writers.
Right.
And it gave them, it encouraged them to keep going.
No, and those speeches apparently, I mean, I think those have been impactful. I noticed on the website for the Whiting Foundation, they have a lot of the speeches archived, so you can read them.
Do they really?
Yeah, it's just that was...
Because I wanted to do that, but some of them wouldn't allow us to reproduce their speeches for copyright reasons or whatever. Well, the agents would let us happen.
So this year, 2015, is the 30th anniversary.
Is it the 30th?
Yeah. And so how many awards are given each year?
10.
10 writers. So that means you've given 300 writers now. And how much the amount is the amount?
Well, it started with 25,000. It's now 50,000.
That's a significant impact, I think. Tremendous impact.
And the wonderful thing is that the selection committee did identify people who became known figures in contemporary culture. I mean, Ian Fraser, and I could go on, David Wallace, and August Wilson. I mean, all these incredible people that if I saw the list, many of them have become regular names in the book world, and they write reviews of other people's work and all that.
Yeah, in some ways you could say the Whiting would be the launching of their careers because you were the first acknowledgement publicly of them as significant.
Harry Dillon.
Yes. I think that's very important.
Mary Carr was one of them, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, the list is an amazing list of writers that you've given money to.
And one of them, Teddy Wayne, is now engaged to my granddaughter, so that's nice. So I don't know if that's helpful, but
no, that's wonderful.
And so Vicky was the inspiration for the idea, and that's good.
It is. So it went at what time? You are no longer the president of the foundation. I know.
I stepped down probably 6 or 7 years ago. But then Andy Grumbach became head of it, chairman of the. So, and now my son Peter's actually going to be head of it.
So it's, I think it's an, and what is the endowment of the Whiting
today?
Now?
I don't know. It's still around 60, I think.
That's a significant amount of money.
Well, you have to spend $3 million a year, and they do that. They spend more than that, I think.
So you have to spend everything that the, or almost everything.
Every foundation has to spend 5% of their assets. So 5% would be $3 million. I think they do. I don't have any idea what they do now.
Right, and of course today, I mean, I think you lived through a period where when you had $50 or $60 million. The revenue from that was significant because now interest rates are really low, so it's probably more challenging for foundations.
Well, you can't do it on the interest or the dividends. You do it on the percentage of the value of the assets.
That's right.
And it's called total return.
Right.
And the endowment management uses that expression to, so you really, you're living on capital gains, what it is.
Right.
And so you have to have, and over time, the, equity investments for over 50 years have averaged a 9% return.
So more than enough.
So you can spend 5 and still have some growth.
Right.
But obviously there's some years when it's 15, some years when it's 0.
Right.
So you have to ride with what happens.
Right. So it's a long-term thing. Well, it's an amazing achievement, I think, that it's a nice thing to...
I get credit for what other people do. So
nothing wrong with that.
Okay. Yeah.
No, and it's, I think it's really, it's a wonderful thing that your wife's interest in poetry led to such an amazing long-term effect on so many people's lives. So,
yeah.
That's really an amazing thing to think about.
It is. That's a legacy.
It is. It's a great legacy.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking to me about...
I hope you got this on tape, you think?
Yes. Yeah. It recorded. Everything is fine.
Good.
And thank you for doing that.
Good. So, fine, David.
Appreciate it.
Fine.
Thanks, Bob.
This has been Publishing Talks. I'm your host, David Wilk. You've been listening to my conversation with Robert Penoyer. Thank you once again.